Hi, this is Mark Iverson, owner and founder of Ida History, a Boise area small business devoted to historical tours and content. And lately, I've had a question. Question based on a term. A term that I've heard thrown around the political arena and the news perhaps too often. And that is real Americans and the real America. To me, America is a place full of diversity in thought, religious belief, culture, history, and political views. To claim that you are a real American and you comprise a real America is to say you possess something, possess a nation built on how you are and what you perceive to be right. And of course, to me, that is relative to who you are and where you come from. And so I wanted to talk to Americans, great many Americans, Americans from all walks of life, all colors, sexual orientations, genders, religions, and etc., and see what they think a real American is, or if there is a real American. And I want to get their experiences down in conversations recorded, because when you get a person's experience, you understand them a little bit more. And thus, you empathize with their situation and their reality in America. And so, join me. This is the Ida History Conversations Podcast. Thanks to the Trendy Dads for that great piece of music. It's a cover of the B-52's Private Idaho, and it's the perfect opening. All right, well, this is the Ida History Conversations Podcast, and, well, I've been talking to a friend of mine, an author, Tomas Baeza?
Correct.
All right, kind of got it. Yeah, clap. And so, basically, I said the theme of the show in the intro, but I want to talk to people who have they're grounded in history, and you have at least your master's. You got too many degrees, man.
I have a bachelor's in history and essentially two master's degrees in history.
And then you went to, although I hate the Ducks, University of Oregon.
I went to U of O and ended up finishing my doctorate in educational statistics.
Okay. Well, so I don't hate the Ducks as far as the college. I don't like their football fans. And that is universal, you know, across the board. I find that they're always in the top five most dickish schools as far as football fans, which doesn't make sense, you know, to me, because it's like Eugene is a peace love kind of place, I guess, but maybe not. But that's neither here nor there. But it is a conversation of identity. And so, you know, I've always, for the last, I guess, 2 years, I'd say almost every day, I think about this comment, this kind of term, real American, true American, those who are like holding that beacon on the hill kind of mentality, right? And I'm like, I start thinking to myself, what the fuck is a real American? You know, there are many Americans. And in fact, one of the isn't one of the core founding principles of America for what it was back in the 18th century, a diversity in thought, or at least religious practice, possibly. Maybe that's a naive view of it. But so I want to talk to a great many people about how they see their identity in America is and their relationship with American history. And so that's kind of the origin of this kind of a podcast. So, shoot. Just kidding. So let's talk about your background. You know, I've read your fiction, but it's fiction that is not so fictional. It seems very real. Your books are, you want to plug your books? It's always good at the beginning of the show.
Sure. So I've got two books out at this point. I feel really fortunate to be able to say that.
Right.
The first one is the novel Delivery, A Pocho's Accidental Guide to College Love and Pizza Delivery. And then the second one is a hybrid genre collection called A Purpose to Our Savagery. And that contains stories of fiction, creative nonfiction, a blend of the two. And I don't think I have any actual essays in there, but I tried to include a sort of a smorgasbord of approaches to talking about identity and truth and authentic being.
Right. Yeah. And it comes across that way. And I mean, identity, I mean, it's rife with identity, people trying to find their identities. And to me, it's a very American book in the sense that you have people that you're talking about that are from, you know, Latino community, right? And but then you have people who are trying to grapple with gender identity and their sexual, you know, natural sexual selves, I guess, is a poor term. But so there's all sorts of trying to find identity. And I found myself really sympathizing and identifying with a great many people. And I'm a heterosexual white dude, you know.
Thank you. That's actually one of the most important things that I tried to do. So it feels good to hear you say that. I never attempted to write any of the characters in a way that made them special or unique enough to where a reader would have trouble identifying with them. What I wanted to do was try to present people who are either comfortable in their identities or totally aren't, but regardless of who they are or what labels the reader or society might place on them, they still come through as people that the reader can identify with or at least join in their struggle and try to empathize with while they're reading that story.
Right. And that's exactly what, and I've read that fiction can really educate you in empathy. Whereas nonfiction, I do feel a sense of empathy for people I'm reading about in nonfiction. But when you add that texture to it of, you know, this is a human being, this is what they're struggling with, and this is their story. There's great truth in fiction, historical fiction. And so I see a great benefit from it. And so I was telling you earlier that I really grew a lot from Delivery in the sense that I think I said I feel like an asteroid that bounces off a planet. Like, it's just something that changed my idea. Like the first time I heard Public Enemy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like John Irving, we're talking about some of his books, So the World According to Garth. They're just books, and I don't always expect them to come across this way. But I also was grappling with, you know, my own history, how I see America, and how people that look different from me, but I think share that one thread that is, we're all humans and we all feel emotions, but the world doesn't present itself in the same way to us, right? We don't go out in the world, literally, you know, in the same color skin and experience the world in the same way, or as a, you know, a gay man versus a hetero man, or et cetera. And so I think, like, what is a real American? Well, of course, that shit is relative, right? I mean, I feel that, like, and I'm just going to be honest, like, a certain contingent of people, they're defining real America, whatever their perception is, it based off of what they assume to be right and what they feel is the way people ought to be. But yet they're saying that is freedom. That it, you know, respect freedom, but also, they're like, this is how it's expected to be a real American, you know?
I grew up in the Bay Area in the 70s and 80s from San Jose, California. And I didn't appreciate growing up, not consciously, that it's one of the most ethnically, nationally, linguistically diverse communities in the world. And so the whole concept of real American was an alien concept to me. We all were Americans by virtue of the fact that we lived here. Right. Many of the people that I grew up with were not born here. And so it wasn't ever assumed that to be an American, you had to have been born here. You know, my mom was born in the U.S., but in many ways, we grew up sort of under the rules of an immigrant household in some ways.
Right.
And so we were all Americans by virtue of the fact that this is where we lived and this is where we were citizens. Or maybe even we weren't citizens, but we lived here, spent our money here, earned our money here, played out our lives here.
Right.
And so to me, the concept of American was never ethnically anchored. You know, I would read my history books in school, and these quote-unquote Americans who founded the country were just ancient history to me. There were these old white dudes with wigs, and I thought, yeah, I don't doubt their existence. I know that they did some important things, but boy, this place sure has turned into something that they didn't envision.
Right.
And so that was the norm to me. The norm to me was hearing all different kinds of languages, appreciating them for being there, maybe being annoyed that you didn't understand everything that was being said,
right.
But just kind of accepting that as a fact.
Well, and that's what it was to me growing up in Seattle. My mom worked, you know, I'm a suburban white kid, but I was lucky enough to have a mother that worked for the Seattle Parks Department. And so I would go down, I'd meet gay people, I'd meet Black Americans, I'd meet, you know, Asian Americans, I'd meet Latino Americans. I met all sorts of different types of Americans, and they were all fucking nice. Mm-hmm. And they all, I believe, like, the United States is the democracy that we're founded upon, or that our nation, we share a concept. You know, a nation is an ideology, a concept, you know, if in a democracy, or at least that's what I was taught, right? And then I start to learn as I get old that, like, older, that they're, that's not so true. You know, like, oh, the founding fathers, they held slaves. Well, why is that? Well, you were all human beings and equality. It's like, well, they didn't see them literally 3/5 of a human being. Right. The Constitution prior to after the Civil War, what, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, right? Didn't consider Black people human beings on the equal level. And then it's like what we write down those concepts as are, you know, our principles on paper, the Constitution. We have to constantly try and live up to those, and we fail. We fail all the time at living up to the principles that we're supposed to. But those principles were written by men who didn't consider other people equal humans.
Yeah.
And yet that was progressive. You know, like, and so it's James Baldwin who kind of writes about this great crux or contradiction in American history. And that is that, you know, until we grapple, and by we, I mean, you know, other Americans, but white Americans, until they grapple with the contradiction in American history, which is racism, discrimination, we're not going to get above. Our nation won't survive. You know, our nation won't survive. And so this back to this idea of identity and the ownership of identity as far as real American, it's like that shows this kind of thinking that a real American is based on what white people define it as.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I kind of wish that I'm glad that I didn't actually, but in some ways it would have been convenient for me to know that we were going to talk about real American, because I've obviously got some strong opinions about that. But I also wrote about that last year. I was fortunate enough to have an essay published, and it's called On Inconvenient Spanglish Characters or Why We Don't Have to Speak in Italics.
Right.
And one of the complaints I received in a critique group about my writing was that I wrote characters who were not real Americans, who didn't speak like real Americans, because in this case, I had a story filled with characters who speak a combination of English and Spanish. And, you know, the typical insulting way of referring to that is Spanglish, but really it's just a blend of the two. And it drove him crazy. He hated it. I mean, he hated the story because this story was Thank You, Cecilia. And so this guy was a Christian fundamentalist, and he was not too happy about the trans and queer characters in the story. But what really got him was the bilingual dialogue.
Huh.
And he blurted out over the Zoom session that we were in that they didn't speak like real Americans.
Exactly.
And he used that term. They don't even speak like real. I hate what you write. Your characters don't even speak like real Americans, despite the fact that millions of people speak like that every day. we're just under the radar. You don't hear us on the radio. You don't hear that or see it on TV. You might see it depicted in a Hollywood film, but almost always in a really problematically nuanced way, usually right. in some kind of gang setting. And so that really spoke to the heart of what offended him about it. Here I was depicting people who weren't real, but more importantly, shouldn't be real.
Right. Yeah.
And I called him out on it, and he ended up kind of tucking tail later on. And, you know, I got to give him a little bit of grace. It seems like he did some work to try to correct himself, but the hatred, the low grade hatred that came out in his immediate reaction and frustration with having to read that kind of stuff was very telling. And I'll admit, it didn't. I'm glad that it challenged him, and I'm sure that it challenges other readers, because I've had other complaints about how characters speak. There's an orthodoxy in depicting exotic language that you're supposed to adhere to when you're writing, and I just don't, because that's not how we talk.
Right, right.
It's not how I grew up speaking.
And I appreciate that. I like that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. There are other people who see it and they put it down. They're not going there. Because they don't want to learn. They don't want to accept that there aren't some things on the page that they can't understand. Really highly literate people are kind of amazing, but they're also pretty entitled. Highly literate people expect to understand everything they read or not be challenged too much.
The professor in your story delivery.
Yeah.
That's what I think of.
Thank you. Yeah, right. Exactly. But the once you challenge, you know, an otherwise really intelligent and knowledgeable person in ways that trouble them, they're either going to lean in and say, okay, I'm up for the challenge, or screw this. This is a waste of my time. And they'll leave it. And for this guy, the fact that I wrote about people who in his mind weren't real Americans was a waste of his time.
And put that on pause for station identification, folks.
I used to be a DJ, so yeah, I get that.
Just kidding. I fucked up with the batteries. We'll be right back.
At this point in the interview, 10 minutes or so of it doesn't record, but we get into a conversation about colonialism and how it applies to identities today. And it's a good discussion, so please continue listening.
What I couldn't ever figure out growing up until I was in my late teens, I think, was the tie between the Philippines and the U.S. Like, okay, they were colonized. How come there are so many Filipinos here?
Mm-hmm.
And then I read about the U.S. military's imperialistic exploits in the Philippines, and I thought, whoa. Wow, colonialism did not stop with the Spaniards.
Right.
Wow. And I didn't know that until I read about it. And I wasn't taught that in school. I picked up some book somewhere and I read about it. And I thought, oh, no wonder they're here.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder. I get it now. And I'm happy that they're here, but not for the reason that I was reading about.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I understand a little bit more about the flow of human populations and economic draws and how colonialism impoverishes nations and makes those nations dependent on the colonizer for, you know, your basic necessities, even to the point of having to leave that country.
Yes.
And so that was an eye-opening experience.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking about when you're talking about colonialism is, and you, I mean, you get this in Rwanda with the Tutsi, right? You get this in anywhere in South America, and you know, the shade of the skin, the lighter it is,
based on
who was the, you know, and that was the same thing in the United States. Obviously, from day one, you got that racialized ladder, which, you know, Adolf Hitler got that from. Mm-hmm. Eugenics, and in America, right?
The Spaniards themselves brought a racial hierarchy with a very well-developed racial hierarchy that, as far as I have read, was developed during the reconquest of Spain.
Okay.
When they had to differentiate between who was a Spaniard and who was a Moor.
Right.
Or an African. And so they imported that here, and it became even more complex when you had to throw in native populations.
Right. And their the stratification, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do more than any community, I feel, is, you know, the tribes in the United States. Oh, we're making a tree with this whole population. It's like, wait, man. They only represent one part of the tribe, or not even the tribe. They're another tribe completely, but it's like, oh, we got this peace deal. It's like, no, that was just with Red Cloud's band.
There's a whole genre of art that, as far as I know, was centered in colonial South America, where you have these really beautiful and well-developed and insidious depictions of what racial mixture is supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were called castas.
Oh, yeah.
And so you would see a parent of one caste or caste and a parent of another caste, or maybe the same, usually different though. And then you would see the offspring and their skin shades and their facial expressions and their physiological characteristics had to conform in an educational way for the viewer. This is what a Lobo looks like. Mm-hmm. This is what someone of this admixture looks like, and this is what their children look like. And it was a way of trying to artistically represent what races were supposed to look like, so that we could codify them.
Right.
It's disgusting. And I was first introduced to that at an exhibition in Mexico City. I just wandered into this open art exhibit, you know, not too far from the Zócalo downtown. And the next thing I'm looking at, ironically, are children and parents who look like me,
right?
Who are a mixture and who look like a lot of the Mexicans walking around me.
Oh, okay.
And I'm thinking, wow, God, those Spaniards and their colonial offspring really, really needed to lock down human appearance, because clearly things were out of control, right? You don't do this. You don't engage in this kind of artistic social engineering if the cows haven't gotten out of the barn, right? People are mixing with people and creating all these new kinds of people that just don't fit, and you don't want them to exist, but God damn it, they do. So let's try to lock this shit down and depict it in art and say, you are this, and you are this, and you are this, but we have to be able to identify you.
Right.
And so that's why I'm hoping that in hearing me say something like that, that as someone who has read the novel, that you're able to go to parts of the novel where the characters, or usually the main character, is so fucking frustrated over other people's need to pin him down, to tell him you are this, that, or the other thing, when in his experience, he isn't just one thing.
Right.
He's a lot of things. And those are all very important things, but in the moment, why are you fixating on that?
Right.
I am right here. I am talking to you. Why do you have to put me in a box?
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of us in our own ways have had those moments where your workplace, or in my situation, it's often been work, or in your social interactions or economic interactions, whatever, they can't really deal with you unless they're able to put you in a box. And I think that's what a lot of my writing has tried to fight against or to highlight. Societies need to put people in boxes so that they're rendered less problematic.
Right. And, you know, I said when I'm reading your book, you know, that if we're talking, I don't know, ethnically, nationally speaking, I identified you with Mexican, right?
And for the record, that doesn't bother me.
Well, no, but the reason I think
that a Mexican from Mexico, they'd be like, "Whoa, really?"
Right.
I don't think so.
But I also get that from your book. You know, I did take that away from your book. As compared to your father's side of things, like, he wasn't around in the picture, so you're talking about your mother, right? But I also got from the book, you know, there's these things like what we talk about as far as our sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are attracted to, gay, straight, bi, you know, a lot of people, even with that, we're far from race. We want to say that there's no scale. It's not fluid. It's not, you know, I got that from your book. Like, I stopped thinking in terms of sexuality. I was thinking of in terms of a love story. Between Danielle, Don, the emphasis on the back of the word, right?
Danielle, or Danny.
And then Saoirse. So, I mean, at first I was...
Getting into spoiler territory, right?
Oh, yeah, we are.
No, we're going to go there. It's a spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Read the novel.
Right.
Stop listening right now.
Right. It's a great novel. You should read it, so don't listen. but do listen. I don't know. But there's a Danny, a heterosexual man. That's how I was thinking at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you know, Saoirse is a trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were talking about, you're talking about people identifying as, like, you know, well, then that makes Danny gay.
I can't help but laugh at that.
That's what people are saying to you. But then it's like, but no, she's a woman. So Danny is straight.
Danny's attracted to a woman.
Right. Exactly. And I remember by the end of the book, I've stopped thinking about that way. And I think I told you once that at the end of the book, I'm like, oh, man, he got the girl. They're together. It's great. Like, you know, in the hotel room, they, you know, they're like, it finally leads to this moment.
And I think of it also, and I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but she got him too.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of found each other by accepting who they and one another are.
Well, she kind of knew. She did know who she was.
Yeah, I deliberately depicted her. Yeah, sorry. Careful.
Yeah.
I deliberately depicted her as the one who has not a better head on her shoulders, but the one who has figured out more of who she is than he has. In my own experience, and I know that I can't generalize too much because, you know, you've met one trans person, you've met one trans person. They don't represent an entire group of people, an individual. But the trans people that I have known, that I've had the privilege of being able to talk to and to know, frankly, have had to do a shit ton of work to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
To figure out their place in the world, to accept themselves, and to not only accept who they are, but to love and value who they are, even if that love and value is not forthcoming from the people around them all the time. And so I wanted to hint at that maybe a little more heavily than I had intended in Saoirse's character. Saoirse has been through her own journey. And I don't, in 630 pages, I literally did not have space or time to be able to go more into that journey. And I also limited myself in the narrative by writing a first person book. So I can't just leave the first person and go into Saoirse's story unless I want her doing a lot of explanation, which gets boring and takes the reader out of the story. And so I was handcuffed there, and I knew it. And in some ways that was good, because there was a part of me that could have spent way more time on Saoirse's story. But I did want to depict her as somebody who has, just to survive, had to do the work. And so she benefits from having gone through that experience, and in many ways is sort of an unexpected mentor for Danny in his own experience.
Right. And I got that. Like, that was clear. And your book is so rife with so many different multifaceted characters that, you know, I'm still realizing my shortcomings as we're talking, and, you know, the need to categorize and understand things. But, you know, I do like that, when I'm reading this book, I am going through a process and evolution of understanding the characters, not as categories, but as human beings, you know? And that, like, yeah, they're pieces of identity in us, but, like, they're a piece that makes up a whole.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like is this nation, the history. It's like, yeah, you have a lot of memory that creates a different group's identity.
Check
in America.
Check you out, pulling it back around to real American.
Well, yeah. Nice. I mean, like, thank you. But I mean, it's true. It's like, there's not a real American or a real America. It's real Americans, real Americas. We all make up a component. Like, you know, when it comes to the history of, like, impoverished white people and impoverished Black Americans back in the, you know, after, you know, Jim Crow era to the great, you know, move west to California, right, in the 30s. You all have impoverished people, right? You have impoverished people, but the difference is this ability to move up the ladder, right? And change and become less impoverished. So yeah, poor is hard. But I think what a lot of people that are from families that used to be poor, and a lot of times they're white, but their folks have moved up the ladder to, you know, comfort and security and economic well-being. That doesn't happen as easily for impoverished Black Southerners, mm-hmm. right? And so you could have this class consciousness, but it doesn't happen because, as James Baldwin said, you know, oftentimes all the rich planter or, you know, plantation owner class had to do was say, oh, you're superior to them based on race. And then class consciousness goes away, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like that identity still is with us, you know, like to this day. It's like, I never had anything. I was poor. It's like, yeah, but you were white poor, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, there's a refusal to admit that. And it's easier to accept the American dream if you're a white person, I feel.
I grew up in a Chicana activist household where the American dream was just understood as a joke. You know, my mom scraped to, you know, put braces on me and to make sure that my sister had transportation and that we had food and shelter. That's what the American dream was, this myth. And what took its place was just getting shit done and getting by. And so that's, I don't know, the American dream is, to me, has always been a slogan. Mm-hmm. And that's ironic because in many ways I seem to have lived it, you know, after I left my mother's protection and went out into the world. So it feels a little bit, I don't know, hypocritical, but I hate the idea of living by a slogan. I am highly distrustful, and I got this from my mother, of orthodoxy.
Yeah.
I do not trust for one minute any kind of system that says we are all supposed to think X, Y, and or Z.
And that's what scares the shit out of me about that term real American.
Yes, because you have to ignore a lot of the real world trouble that you see and maybe even experience to buy into a concept like the American dream.
Well, and for communities that don't accept that, and, you know,
or that have, and they try to achieve it. They've placed themselves firmly under that slogan and say, okay, this is going to be us.
Well, and then you throw racism in there, and it's an easier answer for people to say, oh, there's something biologically wrong for you with you as a Black person. It can't be the system. It can't be a system of oppression and discrimination. I know that I never experienced that as a white person. I had to meet Black people that told me about that shit and then read about it more. Like, I learned that from Chuck D. I learned that from Public Enemy. what my mom gave me was freedom to explore knowledge. And it's like, oh, that shit comes from a history book. It's like, no, I learned more from Spike Lee and Ice Cube and Chuck D than I ever did. And I saw this thing. I saw this clip. My buddy Clay sent it to me. And it's of Ice Cube going on one of the major networks. And they want to talk about gang life and where it comes from. And he, oh, man, this guy is a fucking scholar. He is just explaining it like just like any academic, but from one who's experienced the life he's talking about. Mm-hmm. They cut all of it. Yeah. Because he didn't sound gangster. He didn't sound Black. He didn't sound how they wanted to be. And it's like, but I listen to their rap, man, and there's a lot of knowledge. Like, Chuck D was just, he is so prolific, and he's a scholar. I mean, he's a fucking scholar.
I will never claim to be an expert in rap ever, but one of the things that really opened my eyes and caused me to stop and listen, particularly beginning in the late 80s and through the 90s, to rap, is at certain artists in particular were the ones who not only said things with a lot of intensity, but could also turn the spotlight, sometimes the negative spotlight, on their own communities.
Uh-huh.
Not for the purpose of tearing down their communities, but because as artists, they have the ability to comment on things that, one, they have the ability to comment on oppression on their communities, and they should, but they also had the audacity and exhibited the freedom in the moment, the artistic freedom and maybe cultural freedom, to turn that negative spotlight on their own communities and say, we can and should be doing better.
Yeah.
Don't let this shit hold you down and don't act like this. And you know, there's that one line in Bring the Noise where Chuck D is challenging black radio stations to play his music. And essentially what he's saying is, just because I don't toe the line and spit this message that you expect me to spit doesn't mean that you should censor me.
Right.
I'm challenging you to play my shit. And I love that. I remember when I heard that, that made me feel so good, because it allowed it gave me a feeling of validation when and if I ever felt like I needed to hold my own community accountable. And when I say my own community, that's problematic because, you know, half white, half Mexican, Chicano, what right do you have to speak for a community?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't think I have much of a right. All I really am an expert in is my own experience, but that doesn't mean I can't have an opinion. And so when I heard stuff like that, when I heard rap artists not calling out or criticizing, but challenging their own communities to speak more openly about the ways in which they're maybe not cutting it in this challenging situation, I thought, yeah, thank you. So I was so thankful to hear that, because I thought, that's how I feel too. As someone who doesn't have all the card-carrying credentials of you know, like a hardcore West Coast Chicano, but who identifies as Chicano, then that is allowing me to speak up. And even though I wasn't writing then, it would be like another 30 years before I started writing. That was the attitude that I brought into my writing once I started. I've lived long enough. I have the right to say shit.
Right.
And it might be stuff that family or people from my quote unquote community who don't know me, but for whom I'm writing about familiar things, maybe it's going to challenge them. And I kind of have the right to do that. And honestly, I credit a lot of the early rap artists that I really got into for, you know, like kind of giving me the guts to think like that.
Yeah. You know, and I think about those guys when I want to tell my truth.
Yeah.
I think if there's any personal liberation that I've been going through, they're in the back of my mind, but it's having the balls to say what you feel is true and have experienced through, you know, there's knowledge and wisdom. It's like what you've read about and then what you've experienced out in the world. And then having the balls to say it, and then have people being okay with not everybody's going to like you. You know, yeah. Fuck it. You know, you got to say, you know, it's who's learning from you, you know,
and blow back, push back to expressing an unpopular or inconvenient truth. I think that means different things to different communities. You've spoken with me about white people feeling betrayed by you for taking certain stances or highlighting certain stories or inequities. And that sucks. And is completely believable and I think predictable.
They're saying I'm a race traitor.
Yeah. Oh, God, how fucking 19th century is that? But there's pushback too. And I'm not going to say all communities of color, all underrepresented communities, but there are plenty of Mexican Americans and Chicanos who are uncomfortable with any kind of depiction of our community and our culture in a negative light. And this was in the workplace, actually. This didn't even have anything to do with art. I worked at a place once where I felt like I had some justifiable critiques to how a certain thing was done by colleagues of my background. And I spoke up, and a few of them were really upset with me and were acting as though I was a traitor, as, you know, hey, you know, if you're one of us, you're supposed to support us. And my response to them was like, you know, my mom didn't go through everything that she went through to try and get me through school alive and also educated, so that I could turn my brain off and just say that because I'm Chicano, I don't have to think or exercise any kind of critical thought.
Right.
Why the hell did we go to college? Why have we become educated? Why were we trained to think? Why were we trained to be critical consumers of information? Where the hell's the freedom that we were supposed to achieve if we can't call one another out or say, hey, I think this is bullshit. What we're doing is wrong. This isn't about, you know, like a membership test. We didn't go through all of this so that we could just lie down and not think.
Right. And now you're talking about James Baldwin again, like you're not meaning to, but like we were talking about the great bribe concept.
Mm-hmm.
Like you obviously spent a great deal of your life in academia and educating yourself. But yet there's a wisdom about you through your life experience, which that's a part of, but like through working and living and just being out, being a person in the world, right? But this idea that like it's easy to be quiet and complacent and not challenge the status quo, whatever. But yet it's a bribe essentially to stay quiet. When you have knowledge, perhaps you should put it out there and go for what's not comfortable because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was at a while ago, a couple jobs ago, an event where a very well-respected Latino community leader got up in front of a big group of people. And I wasn't his biggest fan. I mean, I wasn't going out of my way to try and get in his way. But he rubbed me the wrong way in that he demanded a form of loyalty and unquestioning compliance to how he wanted to run things, to where I thought, you're just kind of a tyrant. I don't care that you wrap yourself in a poncho and act all down with the brown.
Okay.
I'm getting, right. Or whatever. I'm not a huge fan, but I didn't go out of my way to be an asshole to him. But he got up in front of a crowd of people, and one of the things that he said was, he spouted this, this tired fucking mantra of the Chicano movement, you know, and I know other movements have adopted it too, but if you're not part of the solution and you're part of the problem, okay. But what I heard him saying too was he was speaking to us, we who were part of what he was about. And basically he was demanding compliance. He was demanding an orthodoxy. He was demanding from us a form of loyalty and complacence that was absolutely against what it was that we were supposed to be working for.
Okay.
And I hated it. In that moment, I broke with him. I'm like, I'm done. I'm like, you know what? Am I going to lose any street cred by not being associated with this person anymore? Yeah, I am. But if that's what it takes to be seen as Chicano, as a member of my community, so to speak, fuck it. I'm out. And so there are various times in my career and my personal development where it probably socially, maybe even emotionally in some ways, would have been not healthy, but easier for me if I had been comfortable conforming and rubbing shoulders with people and in ways that, you know, allowed me to fit in. But I just didn't grow up like that. I grew up this half white Chicano kid who was kind of at war with his mom over who he was,
right,
and at war with all of his schoolmates over who he was and who he wasn't, at war with my father over who I was.
Right.
And so you either cave and become everything that everyone else wants you to be, or you try to figure out, for better and for worse, who you are and who you aren't, and then live like that. And hopefully you figure it out early enough to where you can live a decent life.
Right. Wow. Well, sometimes I just don't have words, man. It's I mean, you're thinking, you're talking about all these different people in your life that you're at war with over your identity. And I'm thinking, fuck, I was at war with myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, me too.
And what I was in America, I think one thing that toxic masculinity is definitely a thing. That was one big thing in me. It's like, I knew I was this person who loved the arts. I like football, but I love the arts. I liked a good romantic comedy. You know, I liked all these things and I hid that guy away. You know, I acted like a fucking hick with chew in my mouth and like, goddamn, you know, gay people and all that. I didn't ever fucking feel that. But I wanted to fit in and not be an outcast. But what I realize is that I'm still chained to myself and what I really feel and what I really believe. And it's like, man, that's not me. Why am I doing this stupid shit? And I'm still figuring it out. Like, I feel, I definitely feel sometimes I wish I wish I knew then what I know now when I was younger, you know? But I'm glad that you feel that too, man, because like I just feel like I wasted so much time like just trying to cowtail to other people, man, like and what they expected. You know, maybe they were going through the same shit themselves. What did I know? And now some of those guys that I thought expected me to do be a certain thing, they're like, oh man, we always loved that, you know, side that always was thinking and you know, knew a lot about history. We love that. And it's like, well, fuck, I should have, you know. So it's like this thing I'm trying to figure out on my own, man. Like, it's better out than in, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Any belch, it's like, don't keep that shit inside. Just let it out. Say your piece, you know? So who knows what it would have been like if you stuck with that kind of guy, that activist that you didn't like, you know? It's just not you, right?
No, it isn't me. It wasn't me. It's alluring. It's tempting, you know, to be able to wear these clothes that others have gifted you and tell you that you look good in. I mean, it's flattering, but if it's not you, then you just feel fake wearing those clothes. My mom found community amongst other Chicanas and some Chicanos and common cause, because I think that it meant a lot to her. And my mom was hardcore. And I love her for that. And her colleagues and compatriots loved her for that. But her struggle wasn't my struggle. And my form of activism was not my mom's 60s era form of activism. You know, I had to figure out another way to try to make a difference. But, you know, you talk about toxic masculinity and toxic patriarchy, and God, that's a whole other area of identity development that I'm even afraid to go into, not because I'm afraid to talk about it, but because we could be here the whole rest of the afternoon and run out of battery.
Seems like we haven't.
It's been a long time. But I won't go down that road, other than to say this whole journey to figure out who I am, not just as a person, but also as an artist, as someone who ended up writing books. I can't ever claim that there was this one moment in my life that acted as the fulcrum between what I was before and what I am afterwards. You know, it's nothing so dramatic. Figuring out who I am now at the age of 56 over the decades has just been this slow kind of torturous process, you know, both as an ethnic person, as a gendered person, insert label here, as that kind of person. And I would like to think that over time it's been maybe not a steady, but a generally upward trajectory towards being better somehow, or being more informed and more aware of one's actions, or aware of the implications of one's actions. And hopefully that all translates into being a better person. But I am confident of this. My mom once got in a fight over whether I should continue my education. I had dropped out of college, which was absolutely not what my mother had raised me to do.
Right.
And so we were kind of having it out one night. And she said, Mijo, all I want is for you to have choices. And education is what will provide you with the choices that I think you're going to need. And what she was getting out in front of without telling me was, as someone of your background, you're going to have to deal with some shit. Mm. And so you're going to need all the ammunition that you can bring to the fight. And education was that ammunition. Also that, and she just wanted me to stay alive, and she knew that I'm more likely to stay alive if I'm in a college environment than just hanging out on the street.
And she was right.
And so
you've got a bunch of degrees. You're alive. You're writing books.
Yeah, I'd ended up in the hospital a few times, so my mom saw what could happen if things went wrong. And so that education that my mom, you know, shoved down my throat, and that I resented at first, did give me choices. And I want to believe that it has helped me to make choices that have allowed me to have more of a difference in the world. You know, that I think the jury is still out there. But what I know is that I also, in pursuing an education and pursuing a career in education, I also know what my mother tried to warn me about, which is that in order to succeed, you're also going to have to make some decisions that in some ways are betrayals of yourself. Like, you can't be your full self. Okay. And without facing consequences. Like, I watched my mom go down in flames multiple times in her career for just being too chicana, you know, and my mom didn't know how to code switch, to her credit. She didn't know how to code switch and be white. She understood what it meant to assimilate, but she was too much in her own skin to act like a white woman. She didn't know how to do it.
Well, so was she not the real America that people say needs to be? Like, she's American, obviously, but it's like, she's not the real America as we wanted.
And so I feel like in my career, I lived a double life. You know, I figured out pretty quickly, especially in graduate school, that I couldn't bring San Jose Tomas to the table without being objectified and made exotic, you know.
And that's in fucking grad school.
God forbid. I mean,
yeah, right.
I can't explain to you how generic I am in the environment where I grew up. You know, the half white Chicano kid, dime a dozen back home. Nothing special.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it. Didn't even think about it, really. Moved to the Midwest, all of a sudden I'm exotic. How the fuck is that supposed to work? I wasn't ready for it. And then you get to grad school where they judge you on a whole other level. And I thought, oh, this is weird. I was not prepared for it. Nobody had ever really mentored me for it. I write that mentorship into the novel, but it didn't exist really. And so I had to figure out why these people were treating me so strangely. And I think I just sort of figured out unconsciously that I had to speak differently. I had to act a certain way. I had to act in ways that caused fewer people concern. And it still didn't work. I still ran into the buzzsaw of people treating me differently or questioning me. And so for as much over the years as I've tried to unconsciously assimilate or very cynically, consciously try to assimilate because I know, oh, this person just can't handle me. I'm going to have to act as white as I possibly can just to get through this meeting.
Whiten up.
Here we go. You know, now I know when to do that and when not to. But I realized at a certain point that I can't keep doing this, at least not consciously, at least unconsciously, I should say. I have to be conscious of when I'm doing it so that I don't just feel bizarre, so that I don't feel this, I'll call it a form of dysphoria, like this cultural dysphoria, you know, the person whose voice I hear in my head isn't mine in this particular meeting.
Oh, okay.
But now, after years of being aware of it, now I know, okay, I need to put on this voice in this setting so that I can seem semi-legitimate. Okay, I can let my guard down in this other area and be more the real me. That all makes more sense now. But on an almost daily basis in my work in higher ed, I in some ways am challenged in my authenticity to be a real American or a real citizen of this work environment. I have to wear certain clothes. On the one hand, it really pisses me off. And then on the other hand, I just kind of laugh at myself and say, dude, toughen up. Your mom had to deal with this shit every single day of her life. She prepared you for this, and it's not as hard for you as it was for her. So just shut up. I bounce back and forth between that self-pity and that anger. And on the other hand, just going, yeah, and you know what? That's the way shit works. You don't have it anywhere near as hard as a lot of other people. And so just ride. Just ride and be quiet. And that part makes me mad too, because if I just become complacent and know that that's the way things are, then I don't challenge it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not helping not just myself, but anybody else. And so that's my struggle now.
Life's a bitch, man.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, I know, but you know, all this, the whole time you're talking, right, you know, when you started talking about your mother and not being able to be her authentic self, you know, or, you know, like she's too Chicana, I think you said. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about these expectations of what America is and what the American dream is and what you're supposed to live up to.
But it's different. It's different for different people. The American dream for some people is you get to be whoever you want to be. and the American dream as imposed on other people, especially within systems like work or educational systems, is you get to be more than you otherwise would have been, but you still need to be here in relation to other people who are up here.
Right.
So the American dream is stratified. It's not equal. I mean, that sounds so stupid to say out loud. Everybody should know this, but it's this huge lie to say that the American dream applies equally to everyone when we know, we should know. Please know, if this is a surprise to anybody who might be listening, please know that it doesn't. We don't all have the same starting lines. And the fact is, the invisible ceilings are set differently for different people. And so only certain people can achieve certain levels of the American dream. And that's just not a happy thing to talk about.
Right. And the people at the top of that don't want to look at that and admit that it's true.
You know? No. And the worst of them are the ones who know that it's absolutely true and do whatever they can to make sure that that's how it works.
And it stays that way. You know, and I.
And there are evil people like that.
Right.
They exist.
Right. Who are you thinking about? No, I just kidding. I
was listening to an interview on NPR a couple years ago, and it was a former investigator for, was it the Department of Justice? One of the major U.S. law enforcement agencies. And he said, card-carrying, you know, tie-wearing white guy, said, we had a saying in the agency that wherever three or more white people in suits get together, something bad's going to happen. And I cracked up because I thought, yeah, mm-hmm. I believe it. I totally believe that. And once upon a time, I'd have said, no, that's not true. That's bullshit. But nope, I'm totally in my mom's court on this one. I believe that.
Right.
And I don't love saying that. And I know that there are examples where that's not true, where there are three white guys who get together and say, let's do good.
But how do you know?
But I think we see too many examples of that not being true to buy into that statement that that investigator made on NPR. So
that's how I feel about a great many politicians. You know, I'm like, I don't fucking know. I mean, John Lewis was gone. You know, I'm like, that's the last guy I kind of trusted. But I guess the way I'd like to finish this off is, how long have you been in Idaho?
I've been in Idaho coming up on 11 years.
Is there a difference in how you carry yourself here versus when you were living in California?
Part of it, I think, is just age. You know, when I was, like a lot of us, when I was younger, I just let more of myself out there because I didn't know what it meant to be disciplined. I didn't know what it meant to have a positive or a negative effect on other people. I was a whole lot more narcissistic as a young person.
Okay, yeah.
So now I think I pay more attention to who I am in situations. You know, maybe that's good or bad. You know, I try not to let it mean that I'm uptight. But no, long story short, I'm not this exact same person as I was when I grew up in Berryessa and Alum Rock in San Jose. But when I go home, I know that that's my home. I know that that's where I'm from. And when I come back here, I do feel different, but I don't feel like I don't have a right to this place. That's what age has given me. You know, if I came here when I was 18, I'm not sure I could function for very long. I feel like I was visiting a foreign country. Now at 56, I'm like, it's just a different place where I've lived. It's not like home, but I am who I am. I'm more comfortable with who I am. But I do know that when I'm in meetings at work, I can't talk like I do with my cousins when I go home. Okay. I can't speak in that same accent. I don't use the same words. I do translate. I do code switch. And mostly it's so that I can function. You know, I don't want to scare my colleagues.
Okay.
I don't want to have to deal with the bullshit that I dealt with a few years ago when it became abundantly clear that I was seen as someone who didn't quite fit in. And I was like, well, you know what then? Fuck it. I'm going to be more of who I am. I'm going to challenge you a little bit more, but I try not to put people through the ringer. You know, I don't bring myself in an inauthentic way just to try to front or to cause them concern, but I am going to call some stuff out. I am going to be a little bit more open with myself. I'll be more authentically ethnic, which is who I am, in situations where in the past I would have been nervous too because I don't want to rock the boat. Well, fuck that. Apparently, just being me in the room rocks the boat. And so I'm going to bring more of myself.
I see the shortcoming on their part. You know, but it's unfortunate.
But when you work within a system, there are people who have power and are more accountable for their, or less accountable for their shortcomings, and others who are more accountable for their shortcomings because they don't have that power. That's mm-hmm. how hierarchies work. So I have to walk that line between being an ethnic person who can operate within a system and being myself, ethnic or not, whose values might or might not align with the system. And so I have to balance the pros and the cons, all the while knowing that I have a family to support and bills to pay.
But yet in that sense of saying, fuck it, you know, one way or the other, that's going to happen. I don't know. It sounds like it actually is a calms you in some way. Like it gives you maybe not calm or like frees you in a sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I can say that. It's something that motivates me. It has forced me to question who I am in both good and negative ways. And so if that leads to more self-awareness, then cool. I do know this. The breaking point between me and the culture in which I have had to reside for so many years just to build a career, there was a breaking point. So I talk about how there was no fulcrum in my life. I guess there was in this one sense. When it became clear that who I was not valued in the environment where I spent a great deal of my time,
right,
that resulted in a feeling of displacement and anger that forced me to start writing. I had to start writing something or else I was going to blow up my life in a way that would not have been happy for a lot of people in my life, including myself. I'm way beyond the habits of youth that I used to engage in that have brought a lot of people down. And so I wasn't going to revert to that and to that form of behavior and coping.
Sure.
But I had to do something. And if I'm not going to lash out in a toxic way, then I ended up writing. That night, I started writing. And so I wrote and started writing stories about people who are searching for a place to belong. If I didn't belong in this place where I had spent so much of my time and I was being reminded of that, then I want to write stories about people who are fucking fighting to get there.
And I felt that in every bit of delivery. And I found a lot of... I felt uplifted by that. I felt a lot of commonality, though not on every mm-hmm. aspect of mm-hmm. the book.
Yeah.
And like when I started talking to you about it, and you know, we've had what, four or five really good conversations, I think. Because I met you at a book sale for the Rediscover Books at the mall.
Yeah.
We started
about a year ago.
Right. We started talking about Soundgarden and all that, you know. So
yeah.
Obviously, we could talk about a great many things, and so, but you know what I felt this whole conversation, and we had a long conversation before we had this conversation, is that I read your books, I've read your writing, I still want to read more, but I felt like, okay, I have a pretty good idea about, you know, identities and fluidness and all sorts of things, and now after this conversation, I've been challenged. I realize I still have a lot of learning to do, and that's good.
And so do I.
You know, just when you start to feel comfortable with what you think is the truth or what you get another person or where they're coming from, that's, you know, I think I realize I'm never going to get fully there, but I'm not going to stop trying.
Yeah.
It's like something that you're always, you know, I'm always looking above that horizon line. I'm going to keep hiking, you know, like it's like I should stop, but no, I want to see what's over that next hill.
Yeah, the moment you think you're fully there, you stop learning.
Right. I want to try to understand people that look different from me. I want to try to understand people that are different religions, sexual orientations, genders, etc. Even though I know I'm never going to fully understand what it's like to be them, I want to learn more. And it's just like I come out of this conversation and I want to know more about a great many different people, their identities and how they feel about America. And that's, I guess that what is what real American, that term means to me, to conclude my part of this, is it means I'm done trying to learn about other people. This is what a real American is. And therefore your experience is just, if you don't fit into that, then you're not a real American. And therefore you're not worth my time. And it's like, there's something very, enslaving in that rhetoric, in the sense that it's just like enslaving. I'm looking for the right word, but it's just basically like you're chaining to yourself to a thought process that's just gonna end your evolution.
Yeah, it's prescriptive in a way that allows lazy people to turn their brains off.
Right.
I'm just going to accept that definition so that I can judge myself and others by that one standard.
And I think racism and bigotry is the greatest example of that. It's like, this is me signing off. This is me accepting something that is invented and not real, but it's real in its implications. You know, racism is a lazy way out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to understand the system of oppression that racism is, because it's easier to say, well, there's something wrong with you as a black person, or as a Latino person, or, you know, homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for me to say, well, one little snippet of the Bible says, like, you know, you should be put to death if you lie with another man. And then there's like, you shouldn't fucking eat shellfish hair. You shouldn't put two seeds in the same, you know, hole in the ground, or you shouldn't lie with a woman that you're not married with or in union. You know, but that one we're going to focus on. So instead of understanding like the biology between the science behind being a gay individual, you're going to say, oh, well, I'm going to give in to homophobia and say that this is wrong. It's just easier to fucking do that.
Yeah. I will never respect any thought or belief system that belittles others.
Right.
Ever. I can intellectually, and maybe even on an emotional level, emotionally understand bigotry or resistance to other ways of being, if that person is basing it on their own experience. Now, maybe it's a very warped understanding of their own experience, or maybe it's a very convenient conclusion, but at least it's based on their own experience, and hopefully they'll then take the next step to challenge that, which I think is often a futile hope. You know, like at one point in my upbringing, it occurred to me, and I was a teenager, that every single fight that I had been in, literally every single physical altercation that, you know, ranged anywhere from a punch to hospitalization, was with other Chicanos.
Ah.
And I was like, and I remember thinking, so if I'm supposed to be resentful of white people, as my Chicana activist mom has sort of socialized me in some ways, how come all the shit I've gotten into has been with other Chicano kids? What the fuck is that about? And I remember, man, you know, I talk about fulcrums, and maybe this was one of those moments. I remember struggling with that, and I was sort of at a crossroads when I look back on it. You know, like, I could have devolved into self-hatred or hatred of others from my community, and maybe saying, well, I guess I am white. Maybe I am totally white. Fuck them. Fuck all these Chicano kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm white. That's how they treat me. That's why we get in fights. I could have fallen into that kind of self-hatred, or I could have, as I did, as it turns out, started wondering, why is that the case? Why are we turning on one another? If we're all facing a common threat from the outside, how come we're feeding on ourselves? And that's how I started to figure it out. And it doesn't mean that I came out of that borderline self-hatred right away. I mean, it took me all the way through college. I mean, I remember walking across campus in college, you know, and I'd see these mechistas, these guys from Mecha, who would just glare at me, you know, because maybe they could sense that I was Latino in some way, but I wasn't down with them and I wasn't coming to the meetings.
Right.
And we would eye one another, and I'm like, this isn't a fucking gang fight. We're on a college campus, man. Who the fuck you guys think you are? And we would just, you know, like, glare at one another. We'd cross paths in the quad. But I remember flirting with the self-hatred then. I remember just like wanting to get in a fight with these dudes to prove myself. And I'm like, nah, I'm on a college campus. Stop it. And I look back on that as me struggling with that whole dynamic of us turning on one another, because we can't punch up, so we're going to punch each other.
Okay.
And so I had to come out of that. I had to learn how to channel my confusion over what was happening into more positive activities and behaviors.
Wow. And you did, and you're still dealing with
something. Trying, man.
I think, you know, you're like, I didn't know you were 56. I thought you were like 51.
No, thank you. I hope that's good.
But what I realize is, like, it doesn't end, man. Like, I feel like there's this, like, part in everybody's life where it's like, oh, I finally got there.
Mm.
It's like, there is like, you die. No. you try to have imparted the best of your knowledge to your kids and those that you can influence.
No, I still struggle with it. You know, in my career, I'm hyper sensitive to not just how I come off, but how other Latinos come off. And part of that, I feel really embarrassed about, you know, who the fuck am I to judge others? Let them be who they are. But if I feel like one of us is dropping the ball,
sure,
I feel like it reflects badly on all of us. I kind of cringe about that. And I feel this sense of ownership that I probably shouldn't feel.
Mm.
But in some ways, I think it's kind of natural. You know, back in my mom's day, you know, the old school crowd would have pulled this person aside and said, hey, man, you got to tighten that shit up. You're making us all look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, not how we operate anymore. Maybe it has a lot to do with this taking place in Idaho, where I think we're nervous to come together as a group because we're trying to blend in, trying to not rock the boat. But I still struggle with, not in this sense, self-hatred anymore, but this hypersensitivity to how we're being perceived in an overwhelmingly white environment like Idaho.
It sucks to be generalized no matter who you are. It's like you're a part of this, like, you know, when everybody assumes that I want, you know, a cranberry and turkey sandwich because I'm fucking white. You know, it's just like, I fucking hate cranberry and turkey sandwiches. I hate Starbucks, man. But yeah, sometimes I got to go there because there's no other option.
I've had people ask me, so where's the best Mexican food in Idaho? And I'm like, man, I don't know. I'm not from here.
Right. Yeah. I was like, so, where can I get a sombrero? You
know? Well, and that made, I was, a few years ago, I asked someone who was born in Mexico and has lived in Idaho for some time. I asked her, you know, where can I get a guayabera? And I felt really embarrassed asking her that because I'm like, well, how is she supposed to know? And as it turns out, she knew. But I felt like maybe I was objectifying her by asking her where I could find a good guayabera. So, I don't know. It works both ways.
The last thing I'll say about myself is that, you know, we were talking about like race traitor, people throw that at my way. But like if on my old podcast, if I'm talking about, you know, like that violence happened between, you know, the indigenous community in Idaho and communities and pioneers,
mm-hmm.
and that it was violent on both sides. You know, and it became sort of a war, not sort of a war of attrition situation. But that the difference is that there's a system of, you know, it's conquering land and resources, and pushing out. You make these desperate people, desperate white people, most often from Ireland and you name it in Europe, right? And then they move west. They're displacing and making desperate.
Mm-hmm.
The tribes and the mm-hmm. people in their way.
Mm-hmm.
You
create the conditions you claim that you're trying to either eradicate or to cure.
Well, yeah, right. I can empathize with an impoverished Irish family that, you know, are running away from, let's say, the potato famine. But I acknowledge the difference is a genocidal system that's being pushed. You know, and people are like, well, how can you, like, I, no matter what, if I identify both sides, people are like, oh, I should, like, somehow identify with pioneers because I'm a white guy. It's like, fuck, man, my people came over in the 1890s and they, you know, basically built barns in Minnesota, North Montana, and Redmond, Washington. You know, it's just like, I can appreciate parts of the pioneers, but I can also acknowledge that there was the part of a system, but there's like this expectation that I'm going to identify with the pioneers and to not give them laurels completely. It's like
a lot of Mexican Americans and Chicanos ignore that Mexicans played a very important role in the subjugation of Native peoples in the American Southwest. I mean, that's a really convenient thing to ignore. We, especially with the Chicano movement, we, have positioned ourselves as allies of Native people, but the fact is our ancestors were in their own way every bit as brutal in their colonial tactics as white European settlers. I did research in Mexico City where I had to do some translation of of, I don't know that we would call them conquistadors anymore, but Mexican imperialist expeditions into the what's now the American Southwest, trying to subjugate the native peoples of what are now Arizona and New Mexico. And the stuff that I translated was just disgusting.
The Puebla?
Yeah. And other indigenous populations. Mm-hmm. And it was just disgusting. The terms were different than American colonialism. It was obvious that the Mexican colonialists and conquerors had a longer history of colonialism. Their tactics were more embedded. Their language was more subtle and developed in how they were describing what they were doing to and about Indian populations. But it was every bit as gross and traumatic and just offensive to humanity. And we don't like to recognize that.
Is there a sense of destiny in the language and that ideology or whatever that puts that?
That's a great question. I don't know. I'm not, even though I studied it pretty deeply, I wouldn't call myself an expert at all in the mindset of Mexican or Latin American colonialism. That's for sure. There was a sense of inevitability in it.
Sure.
I don't know that you could say it was the same thing as what we would call manifest destiny.
Right, right.
But there was just this unstated assumption of superiority. And for that reason, we're doing what we're doing. What I read, the sources that I read, really just treated Indian folks as inconvenient features of the land who needed to be shown how to live and to just not cause fucking problems.
Right. Just accept it.
Yeah. And if there's any major difference that I could determine, just based on the little bit of research that I did, there wasn't necessarily a sense that that Indian people needed to be eradicated outright, like in North American colonialism. But we need for y'all to just go away and stop being the way you are. So either go away or learn how to behave. And if that doesn't work, then we're just going to intermix with you until you're not Indian anymore. Mm. So it was in many ways a more disgustingly practical.
Well, cultural genocide. We're going to push what? Yeah, kill the, save the human, kill the white.
Yeah.
There's this term, right? I mean,
there's this concept in Mexican history called La Raza Cosmica, the cosmic race, and that was forwarded by a guy named Vasconcelos, who was one of revolutionary Mexico's early educational theorists. And La Raza Cosmica was this idealistic notion of the perfect Mexican who was, in essence, raceless. He was a mixture of European and native to the point where native didn't exist anymore. And so it was this backhanded acknowledgement that we are a mixed people, but in our mixture, we have erased the worst parts of ourselves. And it's really insidious.
That's a weird way to think about
it. Oh, yeah.
But then in America, you get this like purity, this racial purity idea.
And the deliberate ignorance of anything that might not be pure, so we'll just hide it. And in Mexico, or at least I should say in this way of thinking, I don't want to throw every Mexican under the bus that they feel like this. They don't.
Sure, sure.
But in this way of thinking, in the early modern government of Mexico, the thinking was, we're going to acknowledge, you know, there's this inconvenient acknowledgement that we are a mixed people. Like, we can't ignore that. Damn it. There were more Indians than us when we got here. And so, yeah, we mixed with them and now we're Mexicans. But we can be even better than that if we acknowledge that in this mixture, we're more than the parts that we brought to the equation. Mm. But we can't be Indian anymore.
Wow. I mean, we all, nations form different ideologies to write shit like that in their heads. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, the sense of destiny, whether it's manifest destiny or it's like, you know, this like blending of races and that's what we're going to become and are becoming, like whatever, like fate you call it, or just that's the way it's inevitably moving. I feel like we always we have to okay this system called slavery that depends now chattel slavery in the United States. So okay, a large portion of white people in the United States say, well, it's a biological inferiority in those that we enslave, right? Or we're taking over the territory in the West, conquering peoples and lands. So inferiority, we're going to say that we have our destiny, manifest destiny to this land. So I'm trying to understand that and what you're talking about. It's just like, it's like bam in my head, like blowing up my brain right now, man. I'm trying to understand that. It's hard to wrap my brain around.
Yeah, colonialism worked differently in Mexico, right? Because of how people populated the land before the Spaniards arrived, before Europeans arrived, was different in Mexico than it was in a lot of parts of what became the United States.
You know, and then I branch out and I gotta shut up because, but you know, you get to caste systems in India that spent, you know, come from, you know, like, well, the colonialism, right? British colonialism, but you get like, you know, and then I find out later that Roma in Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe, like, they have their own caste systems that oppress each other. Like, it never fucking ends. Mm-hmm. It's so, but anyway, to end that, identities are complicated. I think we've just made it more complicated.
They're not inherently bad.
Yeah, right.
I think I say in the novel, I can't remember where I say it. I say it in something that I write, that labels and identities work for you until the moment they don't. You know, there are places where we find solace and protection and community.
Exactly.
Until the moment they hold you back from being the other things that you are.
All right.
And so use them, don't let them use you, I think is how I've had to come to peace with identity labels. Mm. And I don't want to throw them all under the bus because I adhere to some. They're useful for me. But I also reserve the right to not set that identity on the table and say, this is me, if it doesn't serve me in a certain situation. And if I'm not betraying that, but I need to be something more than that, that identity label does not allow for, then I reserve the right to set that aside and say, and I'm also this over here. And I get to be these other things because that's also who I am. I'm not just one thing.
I think that's a good wrap, man.
That's a real American.
Right. Right. Thank you. So, Tomas, Baeza. Reed Delivery. Reed is his newest publication, A Purpose to Our Savagery. It'll make you think. And if you're a person to think that's a good thing, definitely Reed's book. We can pick him up. Rediscovered Books, Flying M Gift Shop.
Flying M, The Lit Room.
The Lit Room. Oh, yeah. I love The Lit Room.
Yep.
Chelsea with you. intentionally lame sounding. And then, well, I know we hate to say it, but Amazon.
Well, yeah, there's that Big River website.
Okay, that's the one. Yep. We all are chained to.
Or if you go to any place that is essentially a marketplace for independent booksellers,
right,
you'll be able to find the books there too. And yeah, so you could go there and find it through Powell's. You could go there through any number of bookstores across the country.
City Light Books?
City Light, yeah, exactly. Okay. So, well, I don't have City Lights. I do have City Lights shirt on, yeah.
Right.
I thought I had Powell's shirt on. But yeah, City Lights. You know what? No, I don't think City Lights. I'm going to call them out. I don't think they have my book.
Well, you got to make it happen.
I've tried. So, you know, you can only get so many people's attention.
Right. Well, thanks for your time. It's been a intense, great, interesting conversation.
My brain
is tired.
Hope we haven't bored your listeners. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much.